The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, a new lens on Ireland's institutional past.
For an institution as multi-layered and multidimensional as a mental hospital or a psychiatric hospital, we need many ways of telling the story.
We'll hear about a project uncovering forgotten voices of patients from the Grange Gorman archives through poetry, history and art. Also, how espionage fiction can be an intriguing historical source.
How much the author is shaping their fiction around their professional experience, and I think some do it to a greater extent than others.
How the popular genre mirrors the various ideologies and political tensions of the 20th century. And the story of the Little Rock Nine. And that's where we begin this evening. In the autumn of 1957, in the city of Little Rock, Arkansas, nine African-American teenagers were preparing to do something no one in their community had ever done before. They were about to make history by entering an all-white school.
Little Rock, Arkansas. The law of the land decrees integration, but racial feeling still runs high in the southern states of America. The law of the land is rejected.
The Little Rock Nine, as they would come to be known, had volunteered to integrate into the Little Rock Central High School after the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court ruling declared racial segregation in U.S. public schools to be unconstitutional.
But no sooner had they arrived than they were off again. Arkansas had evidently decided to make its own laws on the subject of integration.
One of those students was 15-year-old Melba Patillo Beals. She'd grown up in Little Rock, where all she knew was segregation. Now, 83 years of age, she's lived a life of education, activism and writing, a journey that began in the deeply segregated South. Earlier, she spoke to our reporter Colm Flynn about her experience, not just at Central High, but growing up in a world where everyday moments were marked by fear and exclusion.
The thing I remember most is going to the grocery store, and if we had groceries and somebody white came in, we had to step out of line. I remember once touching the potatoes, and I remember touching them, and this woman hit me on the head and called me an ugly name and said, if I touch the potatoes, nobody white would want to buy them. And it was a tremendous torture of one's self-esteem.
And Melba, when you were growing up as a young girl, did you understand what segregation was, or did you just think, well, this is the way it, probably life is for everybody? Or
No. I did not understand what segregation was. I thought, they're calling us monkeys. They're saying we're ugly because we're black. Meanwhile, at home, my grandmother said, God's in charge. God loves us equally. So I said, tell God to put us in charge from January to June. And to put the white people in charge from July to December.
Yeah.
if what you say is true, if he loves us equally, right, wouldn't that do it for you? Then why can't I ride the merry-go-round? Why do I have to sit in the back of the greasy bus?
So, Melba, you went to an all-black elementary school.
Sweetheart, that's a fun question. Only could be asked by an Irishman. There were nothing other than all-black and all-white schools. They were all separate.
After the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional, for the first time in the United States, black students were legally allowed to attend previously all-white schools. And in Little Rock, Arkansas, originally 116 black children were selected to attend white schools. But due to threats of violence and intimidation from groups like the KKK, most of them opted out. But not all. Melba Beals was one of nine brave teenagers who stepped forward to make that right a reality.
You know, I thought like it was like going to any new school. I had my ponytail. I had really long hair. I always had long hair. I had my ponytail. Grandma had made me polish my saddle shoes brown and white. I thought to myself, just like going to any new school, they may treat us badly at first, but then they'll realize that, you know, we're just as good as they are, and it'll be okay. I never, ever thought that I wouldn't fit in and couldn't go.
This is Little Rock Central High School, approximately 2 hours before the school is scheduled to open its doors.
15-year-old Melba thought it would be like going to any other school, but how wrong she was. The Central High School was huge, with around 1,900 white students. And on the morning Melba and the 8 other black teenagers were to enroll, crowds of angry parents started to gather outside the school, along with reporters, who talked about the waving of Confederate flags.
And just moments ago, there was a burst of spontaneous applause as the flag was displayed. From this 500 or 600 persons gathered here, there are approximately 200 National Guardsmen present here on orders of the governor. As yet, there, of course, are no Negroes present.
The 200 National Guards were ordered there by Orville Faubus, the governor of Arkansas, who had called the Supreme Court's decision to integrate a crazy ruling.
The United States Supreme Court in its recent crazy ruling.
He put the National Guard in place to try and block the black students from entering, saying it was to protect the peace.
Well, the first day we walked into school, it was absolute hell. The first day was hell. They said the N-word, go home, you know. People were throwing rocks at us and throwing things at us and yelling at us.
Melba's mother was walking her into school. The men grabbed at her. Some had ropes.
They chased us with a rope. She slapped me and told me to go ahead because they actually, one of these guys had a hold of her and she was going to get hanged. I mean, the guy had a hold of her back of her collar and he was holding a rope. And this is a whole group of guys that are holding ropes. And she just, for the first time in her life, slapped me and said, you go. And you go now. You run as hard as you can. And I turned around and said, no, not going to leave you.
That must have been horrific, Melba. And what was it like when you actually got inside the school? Because I know that things didn't get that much better. They separated you and the 8 other black students. Why did they do that?
There are 1,900 white students in this huge school. So they said, they were being nasty. They said, you want integration? We're going to give you integration. We're going to send you 9 different ways. So they did.
We talked with Colonel William Page, who is in charge of all guard troops here, asked about turning back any possible Negroes who seek to enter the school. He said each case would be determined independently and separately.
Photographs of the 9 black students, the Little Rock 9, being shouted at, being attacked by a white mob, having armed guards stand next to them, circulated around the US and around the world. And with tensions boiling over, President Dwight D. Eisenhower stepped in.
From the President's office in the White House in Washington, D.C., we present a special address by the President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. I should like to speak to you about the serious situation that has arisen in Little Rock. This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock.
On September the 24th, 1957, the president federalized the Arkansas National Guard, taking it out of the governor's control, and sent in the 101st Airborne Division of the U.S. Army to enforce school integration at Little Rock Central High School.
Mob rule cannot be allowed to override the decisions of our courts.
Melba and her classmates endured daily abuse, verbal, physical, and emotional. Some of them eventually had to leave for their safety. But Melba stayed the entire school year.
Here's what I want to really make clear. I don't dislike or hate white people because when I was a little bit older, it would be a white family that would adopt me. And to this day, I have a white family that took me out in California. That's why I'm in California. I came to live with this family called the McCabes. I love my mom and dad. I love that mom and dad were so, he was really the first dad I ever had in my life. And he was McCabe, Irish actually, George McCabe.
I was about to say, that's an Irish name.
Red haired. He was red haired with blue eyes and 6'3" or something, 6'2". And my mom, Carol McCabe, the same. With bangs like my bangs that I have, yeah. And brown hair.
was born by the river.
So Melba, what was it that kept you going throughout high school? Was it a resilience instilled in you from your parents? Was it your faith? What was it that kept you strong during that period?
God, belief in God. The only thing that keeps me going every day of my life, the understanding of my relationship to a higher power, has been the task of my life. I'm angry, I'm hurt, I'm sad, but I believe once again, I know that God's above everything. I just have to keep going, putting one foot in front of the other.
A change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Finally, Melba, if you could go back and meet your 15-year-old self back then, walking into that school, what would you say to her?
It's okay. I had a stomachache. It's okay. God is with you. If you believe in God, it's going to be all right, Melba. And you're going to be surprised when you grow up, because when you grow up, you're going to find out that there's a huge, big world out there. And there are places where you'll be welcome and you'll be loved and you'll be cared for. And those places await you if you just get through this.
Well, Dr. Melba Patillo-Beals, it has been a joy talking to you, and thank you so much for your time.
I thank you for wanting to listen. The greatest present you can give anybody else is to listen to them. So to all of your listeners, I say namaste. Thank you for listening.
Colin Flynn was reporting there. He was talking to Melba Patillo-Beals, one of the Little Rock Nine, about her experience of growing up under segregation and stepping into history to defy it as a teenager. I'm joined now in studio by historian Cecilia Hartzell to talk more about this period in the American Civil Rights Movement. Cecilia, you're very welcome back to the History Show.
Thank you so much, Miles.
Now, that dramatic confrontation over the integration of Central High, in which Mrs. Beals and the other students faced violent mobs and had to be escorted by federal troops, it followed the landmark Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. That was a huge development in the fight to end segregation in America. Tell us a little bit about that case and how it came about.
Sure, absolutely. So, first of all, at the time of the Brown decision, before it was passed, the country was still living under the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court decision from 1896, and that allowed for separate but equal facilities for African Americans. The Brown case itself actually consisted of five local cases of unfair school practices across the District of Columbia and four states. When cases are organized that way in an appeal, they're listed alphabetically, and the decision that's passed is the first case's name. So it was Oliver Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. And Oliver Brown went to court because his daughter, who was a third grader, was forced to walk across railroad tracks to get to a black school a good distance from her house, as opposed to attending a school reserved for white students closer to her house. So that's what the case was about. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, took that case to the Supreme Court. And their argument was that the separate but equal doctrine violated the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And the 14th Amendment, as you probably know, was one of the Reconstruction Amendments. Mm. And it, you hear a lot about it these days because it concerns birthright citizenship. So when that was passed, and that said that any people born in the U.S., including former slaves or naturalized in the U.S., were citizens and they were to be afforded full protection under the law.
Okay. But as we're discovering all over again, courts can make decisions. The decisions have to be enforced. That ruling did not desegregate schools overnight, did it?
No, it was. So there were two rulings. Brown 2 said that the ruling would be enforced with all deliberate speed, which then opened up a window for Southerners then to have delay tactics and to use mob violence to impede that progress. One of the most sort of consequential episodes of that was, I believe it was 1956, 2 years after the Brown decision, the Southern Manifesto was signed by 101 out of 128 Southern congressmen denouncing the decision. And so that gave a permission structure, if you will, to Southern communities to react to violence, with violence and against desegregation.
And did the Brown decision have an impact on a burgeoning civil rights movement in the States?
I think it did. I think the symbolic implications of it, that here is a crack in the wall in segregation, and this is an opportunity then to fight against segregation of schools through the courts. And then symbolically for African Americans, I think it meant that once this was on the board, then perhaps this would be extended into other areas of society, again, backed by the courts.
As we heard in the report, it was Eisenhower's decision to use federal power, to send in federal troops, and also, I think, to federalize the Arkansas National Guard, mm-hmm. which had been used in a very different way by the governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus. That's what broke the stalemate. But was his hand forced, or was this something that he did willingly?
His hand was forced. Now, personally, it was said that Eisenhower favored a slow but steady progression of civil rights. And as president, he thought that the government should only be involved where it had the authority to do so. So that's where this lull happened in him dealing with this crisis. And ultimately, as he said in an address to the American people, he said, actually, it's not about what I believe. It's not about what anyone believes. It's about upholding the rule of law. And as president of the United States, my role is to make sure that Supreme Court decisions are enforced and federal laws are enforced. He famously said that the two most difficult decisions he ever had to make was one as the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe during World War II to issue the go order for the D-Day invasion of Normandy, and two to send the 101st Airborne down to Arkansas.
And an Irish weather forecast played a huge exactly. part in the first one, not however, in the second one. Now, all of this is happening against the backdrop of the Cold War and of the use of American hard power, also the use of American soft power. How important do you think the optics of what were going on in the South were important in the context of the Cold War?
Extremely important. I mean, when you think about it, in terms of the Cold War, the product that America had to offer in terms of fighting the Cold War was American democracy. And any kind of tarnishing of that, any kind of understanding that perhaps the rule of law was tarnished by mob rule, that again affected our power, our global power, our global image across the world. And then all those countries that came of age and gained independence after World War II, it became that much harder to convince them not to go communist because, you know, we weren't actually upholding this rule of law.
Now, also in 1957, there was a Civil Rights Act. It was around the same time as the drama was unfolding in Little Rock. That's not a Civil Rights Act that we, I think, hear too much about these days. I mean, civil rights we think of as LBJ, as 1964. How effective a piece of legislation was it?
It wasn't effective. It wasn't implemented in a very effective way. But again, it was another chink in the armor of segregation. That act was about voting rights. And since Reconstruction, since the end of Reconstruction in 1877, the South, even through up to the Civil Rights Acts and Voting Rights Acts in the 60s, the South used intimidation, poll taxes, literacy tests to keep African Americans from voting. And that's what that was about. That was the power of the federal government to get involved to mitigate those circumstances. Again, it paved the way for the 1965 Voting Rights Act, but it wasn't effective as such at the time.
Now, the standoff in Little Rock didn't end in 1957, because in 1958, the governor of Arkansas took what looks like or seems like an extraordinary step, closed all public high schools in Little Rock for the entire academic year, which seems like an act of atrocious self-harm, really. But what impact did that have? What did it do to the controversy?
Well, listen, I like to talk about that time, and because, listen, at that point, you're under 100 years from the end of the Civil War, right? And the public memory of the war was so powerful in the South. And that's what led to this kind of decision. And it's all well and good. Again, this states' rights versus federal power, that echoes from the Civil War, and that was what was still going on. It's all well and good to close the schools, but when they're opened, they then have to comply with the Brown decision. So it was just putting off the inevitable, but very powerful at the time.
Is what we're seeing now in the USA, do you believe, a regression to the era before Eisenhower did what he did in 1957? In other words, he essentially respected a court decision and intervened. Are we heading backwards? Are we there already?
I think we're there already. I think what I and many people took for granted was that we live in a nation, I lived in a nation of goodwill, right? And that the foundation of American democracy depended upon a lot upon that goodwill and the respect for law. And if there is neither one of those things, how do you preserve the democracy? So I'm a bit concerned about that. And again, birthright citizenship is raising its ugly head again now.
Well, in 1957, it took 9 brave teenagers, extremely courageous teenagers, a Supreme Court decision and the presidents of the United States to force open the schoolhouse doors. And the fight for equality didn't end there, of course, as we well know. But that's where we leave the story this evening. My guest is historian Cecilia Hartzell. Cecilia, many thanks for joining us again on The History Show. And after the break, uncovering forgotten voices of patients from the Grange Gorman archives through poetry, history and art. Stay with us. Welcome back. For about 200 years, Grange Gorman in Dublin was home to a psychiatric hospital, famous for its size and the scale of its ambition in treating mental illness. The Grange Gorman Histories Project is a public history initiative, exploring, cataloguing and reflecting on the eventful history of the area. While historians document this complex past, artists use creativity to illuminate what official records leave unspoken. In this piece, writer and publisher Jonathan Creasy explores the intersection of poetry and archives, revealing how verse can uncover the hidden history of this institution.
The patients all seemed happy. Of our total patients, 85% would be of the chronic or hopelessly incurable type. Some of the patients were having their backs rubbed, and they all looked most comfortable.
That's poet and playwright Liana O'Hara, whose new book, The Patients All Seemed Happy, is a poetic exploration of voices and stories from the historic Grange Gorman Asylum.
As a poet and a person, I've always been interested in underrepresented and silenced narratives. I think history is not written for the majority by those subjected to it. And I think looking for these stories is not necessarily a way of rewriting history, but at least shining a different light on it or bringing different and obscured histories to the light.
The area known as Grange Gorman sits on the north side of Dublin City, surrounded by Stonybatter, Smithfield, Phibsborough and Cabra.
Well, the word Grange Gorman refers to an area in Dublin, but most often in history it refers to the psychiatric hospital, which was founded in 1810, opened its doors in 1814, and it continued to treat patients for 199 years until it closed in 2013.
That's the voice of Brendan Kelly, consultant psychiatrist in Talla Hospital, professor of psychiatry in Trinity College Dublin, and author of Asylum, Inside Grange Gorman.
Over the course of its almost 2 centuries of operation, Grange Gorman admitted and treated many people who, as best as we can figure, did indeed have what we would now call mental illness, but also other people, many people with intellectual disability who had no other place to go, no other supports, ended up there. Many people with alcohol problems ended up there, as did a huge range of other people who were simply unwanted or found no way to fit in their communities or their societies. Asylums, the mental hospitals, are an incredibly important part of Ireland's social, medical and institutional history. Grange Gorman in particular, the site included a psychiatric hospital. It included a prison, a workhouse, which accounted for a third of admissions to the asylum at various times. And also there was a fever hospital nearby and a surgical hospital. So what we have here is a collection of institutions which shaped the surrounding area.
For the last 5 years, a network of Irish institutions, including Dublin City Council, Grange Gorman Development Agency, the National Archives, the HSE, the Royal Irish Academy, TU Dublin, and local communities, have engaged in a process of remarkable historical recovery.
Grange Gorman Histories is a public history programme aimed at uncovering the history of this site and its institutions and the community surrounding it, and the ripples and echoes of all of this institutional activity across Dublin and Ireland in general.
There was a very good selection of pictures hung on the walls. These refinements help to remove the institutional look and assist towards the restoration of the patients.
O'Hara's poems are drawn from the archives. They evoke the voices of patients, nurses, and families, but also the official language of the institution, whose view of the patients' lives often contradicted reality.
In the hospital wards, the patients were well cared for and all looked happy. They had no complaints. The beds and patients were well kept and the patients comfortable. The patients were comfortable, clean and tidy.
One of the interesting things about Grange Gorman Mental Hospital is the number of governmental reports, inquiries and inspections that happened. And often these are well-meaning but utterly disconnected from the reality of life there. And that's why I really like the title of Liana O'Hara's new book, The Patients All Seemed Happy. You know, because for much of the time, I'm sure to the external observer, the patients whom they saw did indeed seem happy. And look, maybe some were. Some did find asylum in these mental hospitals, but many didn't. So the title, The Patients All Seemed Happy, really taps into this gap between perceived reality and what we want to see. It suited everyone that the patients seemed happy or that someone decided they seemed happy. The gap between that and the reality, which is very vivid in the poetry itself. The patients all seemed happy. I've no doubt they did, but perhaps the stories bubbling beneath were very different indeed.
The patients were very happy looking. The patients were mostly quiet and well behaved. All the patients seemed very comfortable and happy. We received the usual numbers of complaints from patients, mainly requests to be released.
At one point, Ireland had more people in mental hospitals per capita than any other nation in the world. But the country did not have higher rates of mental illness. The institutions had grown out of control and become unsustainable.
The history of Grange Gorman is always the history of other institutions which tended to follow on. So in the 1970s, determined efforts were made to scale down these institutions as tolerance for institutions declined in general. The psychiatric hospital at Grange Gorman was most recently called St. Brendan's Hospital. It closed its doors to admissions in 2013. And since then, TU Dublin have redeveloped the site. Now, many mental hospital sites are being redeveloped around Ireland, but this is the most transformative across the country. And that radical transformation of the landscape prompted many people to say, this is historic change. This is a huge shift. So the Grange Gorman Histories Project was born naturally at this time of transition. And anyone who's familiar with the TU Dublin campus at Grange Gorman now will know that it is a beautiful campus filled with space and light. And the terrible irony is that when Grange Gorman Mental Hospital opened in 1814 as the Richmond Asylum then, it probably looked a lot like that. Beautiful buildings, lots of space, lots of light. And the real tragedy in this story is that for two centuries, patients treated there could have been treated in this kind of beautiful environment, which is intrinsically therapeutic. So Grange Gorman Histories was born out of this sense of transformation because we stand at a historical moment for this site and for the development of mental health services and for the development of third level education. There's so much to explore and celebrate.
That celebration requires a multifaceted, even experimental, approach.
For an institution as multi-layered and multidimensional as a mental hospital or a psychiatric hospital, as well as the other Grange Gorman institutions, we need many ways of telling the story. We need more traditional histories, facts, figures, buildings, personalities. We need that for sure as a sort of a backbone to the story. But we need about 100 different kinds of history in addition to that. We need to try to listen to the voices of patients in the institutions. And that is very hard to do.
To approach this complexity, Grange Gorman Histories commissioned artists to creatively mine the institution's past. Liana O'Hara worked in the National Archives and conducted interviews to give shape to her new Grange Gorman poems.
So for quite a long time, over the last year, I spent just doing research, like going into the archives, looking at nurses' reports and patient records, anything I could find, really. I'd find sometimes even just a word or a sentence or a photograph or an object that would somehow strike me as significant and that would prompt a story. Like one of the poems is called The Lightkeeper's Daughter. It's written from the perspective of the father of a patient. The fishermen's wives are calling again. Afraid those out at sea will not be returning in time for dinner. I tend to the light and silence.
Poetry, particularly when it's rooted in time spent with archives, can bring forth a different kind of story. It can bring forth a different tone in the history, a different dimension to that which might be possible through, if you like, pure historical study.
I think that patients should be seen as people, and I hope that poetry can help in achieving that, that these poems can help create greater compassion and a sense of understanding towards people who might not be like you.
Jonathan Creasy was reporting there on the Grange Gorman Histories Project. And Leanna O'Hara's book, The Patients All Seemed Happy, will be launched at the Royal Irish Academy tomorrow, Monday, the 7th of April. It's part of a new series, Writing Ireland, devoted to the creative use of archives to explore Ireland's social and cultural histories. And the book will be launched by Dr. Brendan Kelly. After the break, reading espionage fiction. We'll explore what spy novels reveal about the history of espionage. Stay with us. Welcome back. Espionage has shaped the course of history, from the secret agents and code breakers of World War II to the double agents and defectors of the Cold War. Intelligence operations have influenced diplomacy, fueled conflicts, and decided the fates of nations. But beyond the real-world spycraft, espionage fiction can be a useful historical source, as this popular genre mirrors the various ideologies and political tensions of the 20th century, and as a number of the practitioners of the art of espionage fiction were also involved in real espionage themselves. Joining me now is Martin Griffin, Associate Professor in the Department of English at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. He's the author of the book Reading Espionage Fiction, Narrative, Conflict and Commitment from World War I to the Contemporary Era. And he joins me now on the line from Knoxville. Martin, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you, Miles. Glad to be here.
Now, let's start with your own connection to espionage fiction. I think you've been a fan since you were a very, very young man. And I think you have read espionage fiction that most of us wouldn't even recognise, most of us would never have heard of.
That's true. I certainly started reading espionage fiction when I was maybe around 12 or 13. I became fascinated with it, and certainly there are a lot of novels that came out in the late 60s, in the 70s, probably most of them long forgotten and out of print, but there was something that made a large impression on me. And I, you know, this is many years later, of course, many decades later, but I knew, you know, when I became a professor that ultimately I wanted to write something about it and to go back and look at not only the well-known names, but a few of the more obscure ones as well.
Because it's a genre that goes all the way from pulp to literary, isn't it? I mean, you've got pulp espionage fiction, you've got literary espionage fiction, the Le Carrés of this world.
I think you can say that, yes. There are definitely authors who have been more ambitious than others. They've aimed for something a little more complex, a little more probing. And I guess I argue in the book that authors, in a sense, they created the genre for themselves. And many authors, I think, have also worked in it, but also tried to get beyond the genre, which has been difficult, I think, and it has worked for some people, not for others.
Now, I'm assuming that, or at least my information is that you've never worked in intelligence, and if I said otherwise, you'd probably have to kill me. But as far as you can divine, how realistic is espionage fiction compared to actual intelligence work?
I think it depends a great deal on what the author wants to do. I mean, some espionage fiction authors have had substantial or reasonable amount of experience themselves in intelligence work. Curiously, I mean, two people whose novels are often seen as diametrically opposed in style and atmosphere, Ian Fleming and John le Carré, both worked in British intelligence at different times. And to an extent, obviously, I think most authors who write about a professional milieu that they have worked in themselves, whether it's medicine, whether it's education, whether it's intelligence work, whether it's journalism, they do bring their experience to bear upon their writing. But of course, at the end of the day, most of them want to be recognized as novelists. They're not, you know, history writers. They're not doing a documentary film. So I think it very much depends on how much the author is shaping their fiction around their professional experience. And I think some do it to a greater extent than others.
Okay, well, let's talk about those two that you mentioned specifically, Ian Fleming and John le Carré. Fleming, who was involved in espionage during World War II, and le Carré then involved subsequently during the Cold War, worked for both MI5 and MI6. In the case of Fleming and his creation, James Bond, is that just a kind of a comic book fantasy version of espionage?
That's probably a fair description. And to an extent, I think Fleming might have agreed with that, or at least he might have agreed with it, you know, one day and disagreed the next day. But he definitely had a fair amount of experience at the administration and planning levels. He had been in journalism. He'd tried his hand at a couple of jobs, failed at being a stockbroker, for example. He worked as a reporter for Reuters and was actually in Moscow in the late 1930s, covering one of Stalin's show trials. At the beginning of the war, connections got him into the Admiralty and he became involved in naval intelligence. And it turned out he had quite a talent for administration, but also planning covert operations and deception strategies. And he, if you like, had a sense of the atmosphere of intelligence. But for Bond, I think there was something else going on he wanted. I mean, you said perhaps kind of comic book or cartoon figure. I think it was Bond was an attempt to inject a sense of glamour into what was really an unglamorous profession.
Now, there are Bond short stories, there are Bond novels. You've read the shorts, obviously you've read the novels and the short stories, but is there a difference between them, or is James Bond pretty much the same in the novels and in the short stories?
The short stories are interesting. Certainly, they often look at Bond, they often present Bond from a different angle than what you see in the novels. The first few novels that Fleming published, the first five or six, beginning with Casino Royale, which I happen to think is quite a decent piece of work, they were mostly well received. He got moderate to positive reviews. And the second phase, the novels he wrote in the 60s, which had less of a Cold War theme, that had a touch of not exactly fantasy, but they were far removed from the somewhat more authentic settings of the first few novels, they began to generally receive negative reviews. It was ironic, perhaps, because that was the moment when the film people stepped in and the Bond movie franchise was born. But I think that the short stories sometimes have surprises. There is a short story called A Quantum of Solace, which was much, much later the title of one of the films, nothing to do with the story itself, But that one genuinely surprised me. It's set in the Caribbean. It was published about 1959, just about the time the Castro rebellion was about to take power in Cuba. And obviously, Castro then turned very much toward the Soviet Union. So it was somewhat of a surprise to see in the story a moment when Bond says that, if anything, his sympathies are with the Castro rebels. That, let's say, was not exactly an expected position that you would think that Fleming would have his character take. So there are certainly in the short stories some unexpected elements that show Fleming, show Bond in a different light.
Now, when it comes then to Le Carré, he's quite the opposite, isn't he? I mean, George Smiley, you've got to see George Smiley as anti-Bond. He's very, very different.
Very much so. I think that's it's often perhaps been a little bit exaggerated, but I am not sure really if Le Carré himself consciously intended to put something out there which was diametrically opposed to the style and atmosphere and implication of Fleming's novels. But he began quite early on to be regarded in that light. And certainly there were elements in Le Carré, the portrayal of the bureaucratic nature of intelligence institutions, the portrayal of a kind of cynical expediency that showed intelligence organizations willing to accept collateral damage. I mean, innocent people getting caught up in something that they have no way of controlling. And having, in the case of Smiley, a middle-aged intelligence officer, you know, a very unglamorous figure who is deeply in love with a wife who likes him but follows her own feelings, takes other lovers, and in a sense, these novels present Smiley as the opposite of a darkly romantic Bond-type figure.
The chapter in your book on Le Carré is called John Le Carré and the Jews. So, I mean, that's an example of a layer to his novels that you discovered rereading them as an adult, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. It wasn't something that I particularly noticed when I read Le Carré when I was younger. But going back and reading the early novels again, and also reading some academic studies of Le Carré, I mean, Le Carré is one espionage author for whom there is a certain amount of scholarly and critical writing already. If you read from his very first novel, Call for the Dead, published in 1961, right through to The Tailor of Panama, which I think is 1996, you can see a sort of through line. You can see these characters who are Jewish, sometimes half-Jewish, who play different roles, usually but not always a secondary figure, but often an important figure. And their Jewish identity is problematic in some way. It makes them partly insiders, especially to English culture or British culture. They seem to hover a little on the edge of acceptance. There's a certain historical trauma that they sometimes carry, as Elsa Fennin in his very first novel, who is a German or Austrian refugee who survived the Nazis, right down to the protagonist of The Tailor of Panama, who is actually pretending to be Jewish, but in fact is not. And that novel itself is a kind of homage to Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana. But the role of the Jewish character as a kind of half outsider, half insider, somebody who carries a certain weight of historical vulnerability with him or with her, I think that's quite striking when you read Le Carré's novels all the way through from the 60s to the 90s.
Now, in one chapter, you look at the work of Gerald Seymour, the English writer who previously a journalist who wrote three novels about espionage in Northern Ireland. The first of those is 1975. That's Harry's Game, which was, of course, famously turned into a TV series. And then you have Field of Blood. That's 10 years later. And then finally, The Journeyman Taylor in 1992. So there's 15 years between book one and book three. Do those novels reflect the different phases of the conflict between 75 and 92?
I think they very much do so. If you take them as a trilogy, I mean, I call them a trilogy in my book, although the stories themselves are not kind of connected in that way. But the setting, the thematic elements definitely show a progression. I think Harry's Game, which was actually Seymour's first novel, it came out in 1975, that was when the conflict in Northern Ireland was obviously in its early years. It was a little unpredictable. In the early 70s, it wasn't necessarily clear that this would go on for 30 years. There was an element of unpredictability. Something might happen. You know, there might be some move by the British government. There might be some move on the side of Sinn Féin and the IRA that could change things. When you get to Seymour's second novel, Field of Blood, the primary theme is the Supergrass project, where, you know, British intelligence and the RUC and the Crown Forces attempted not only to penetrate Republican circles and the IRA command structure, but also try to get people to turn, essentially to give evidence in court against their comrades. This was at a time when the conflict had become mechanical in a way. It was almost as if the roles of, say, the British forces, the role of the IRA, had become set in a groove, as it were. Nobody could get the edge. And I think the British, clearly by the early 80s, had decided that military force was not going to offer the successful solution. And the Supergrass project was a way of trying to get that edge. When you look at his last novel of that trilogy, The Journeyman Taylor in 92, which I think is the best of the three, I think it's a very powerful piece of work. By then, there's a feeling of war weariness. I mean, it's been over 20 years. And again, it's something of an impasse. The British, the RUC, they can't move beyond a certain point. And on the side of the armed struggle and militant Republican movement, it was obvious that they, in a sense, had also reached a point beyond which they did not seem to be able to move. And there were several attempts to kind of make, to try and do something dramatic which would change the situation. And I think the IRA, the Canary Wharf bombing, I think is a good example of that. But you take the three novels together, Harry's Game, Field of Blood, and The Journeyman Taylor, and I think you get a very good feel for the way the conflict in Northern Ireland developed over those 25 years.
Well, the book is called Reading Espionage Fiction, Narrative Conflict and Commitment from World War One to the Contemporary Era. It's published by Edinburgh University Press. The author is my guest, Martin Griffin, and the book is out in paperback this summer. Martin, many thanks indeed for joining us on The History Show.
Thank you, Miles. I enjoyed it.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Liam Mullen and Paul Murnock on sound, and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.